Good evening. I came all by myself tonight, so I'm going to do the entire show. Come out, writers, come out. Joan, Terrace, Candace. You've scared them. They can't come out now. They're too scared. They're back there for all time. Come out. Okay, give them a welcome. They're not that scary. Well, they're kind of, are you kind of scary or are you not so scary? Okay, so will you please welcome our writers who've bravely come onto the stage? Yeah. My name is Charlene Deal. I'm the director of the Winnipeg International Writers Festival, and we are here for the third main stage show at MTYP, a theater that we love, and a great home for us during this week-long party of books. Let's just start by giving a clap to the great folks who make MTYP such a terrific spot. And our sponsor tonight is CTV, which I think makes sense since our show title is Real Life. And we all know that's what the news is all about. So will you please put your hands together for CTV. Before we launch into an amazing array of stories tonight, I want to acknowledge that we're gathered on Treaty 1 territory. This is traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Ojibwe, Dakota, and Dene peoples in the homeland of the Métis Nation. And we have been gathering all week down here at the Forks, which is an ancient place for trading goods and stories. And so we continue on this very rich land and this very rich history. And tonight we are going to be exploring all sorts of stories that have connections with real life. They may be fiction based on real events, or they may be nonfiction, exploring the dimensions of actual historical moments. They may be investigations into how we tell history or find history or recreate history, and how we make real lives for ourselves and one another, and how we understand what real life might be in all of its glory. So we have five writers tonight, and it is a really spectacular lineup. I'm very excited. And we begin with a local hero who has just released a novel to tremendous reviews. Would you please welcome Joan Thomas with Five Wives?
Thank you so much, Charlene. We really didn't have cold feet back there. We were just reading Charlene's lips and trying to decipher it, but I'm very, very happy to be here. This is a story that's been on my heart for a long time, and it's a thrill to have it out into the world. And I'm especially happy to be presenting it to you with a professional projectionist who will be sharing some images with you. So we're going to start right away with this photograph, which was taken in January 6, 1956, and it's iconic to anybody who grew up in a certain kind of Christian church in the 1960s. On the left is an American missionary pilot named Nate Saint, and on the right is a Warani hunter-trekker from the rainforest in Ecuador. His name was Nenkiwi, although Nate Saint never learned it. Nate and his friends had flown in a small plane and set up camp on the Kururai River in an elaborate effort to reach Nkiwi's people. And on the fourth day, a group of Warani people visited their camp. How do you entertain guests when you have no language in common? The Americans offered hamburgers with mustard. They smeared insect repellent on their visitors' backs. They played the harmonica. They demonstrated the yo-yo, they blew up balloons, and they were thrilled by their success. Their enterprise was called Operation Alka, and it involved five American men. These men were a bunch of high flyers. Ed McCulley on the left was a law student. Peter Fleming was doing his PhD in philosophy. Jim Elliott was a celebrated young preacher in the U.S. The Wurwani people had never had a peaceful contact with the outside world. They were famous for defending their territory with extreme violence, and they became the holy grail of American evangelical missions. I almost got the impression when I was researching this story that these men were looking for a mission commensurate to their own specialness. The Wurwani successfully defended their territory again that January of 1956, and the exposed film in Nate Saint's camera, when it was recovered from a sandbar in the Kururai, actually looked like this. The men of Operation Alka left behind 5 wives and 9 little kids. Elizabeth Elliott, one of the widows, was a 29-year-old with a tiny baby when she was recruited by HarperCollins to write her memoir. She was a wonderful writer, and she directly tackled the question Operation Alka raised. If God had called these 5 men to this mission, why did he let them be killed? In her book, Elizabeth Elliott molded Operation Alka into the shape it has retained for many people to this day. The men were indeed led step by step by God, who intended to make martyrs of them. That book, Through Gates of Splendor, has sold 500,000 copies, and it still sells well. And I'll just say for writers in the room that the current edition has 22,000 ratings on Goodreads and an average of 4.4 stars. And this is 60 years after the event. As it turns out, the killing of the men was just a prequel, because the women stayed in Ecuador, most of them, and within a couple of years, they had accomplished what the men had failed to do. They were living peacefully with a Wurwani clan, teaching the gospel, and evangelicals or Christians around the world rejoiced. Wurwani converts were toured to the U.S. to sing Jesus Loves Me at Billy Graham rallies. And in this picture, Rachel Saint poses with 2 Wurwani men at a missionary conference in Berlin. Of course, it's a story that the secular world reads very differently today. For the Wurwani, this intrusion spelled the calamity of contact diseases, the end of a traditional way of life, the loss of language and culture. In fact, I was drawn back into this story through reading about the environmental impact of oil extraction in the rainforest. Wurwani activists are currently at the forefront of the fight to save the rainforest in Ecuador. I became curious about connecting the dots between the stories of Operation Alka I had heard as a kid and the takeover of Wurwani lands by the oil companies. It turns out that link was far more direct than I ever would have imagined. And it was that discovery that led me to write 5 Wives. I admit that at the first I took some satisfaction in debunking these white savior narratives. But diving into the research, what struck me was not just the cultural arrogance that prompted the mission, the magical thinking, the sense of exceptionalism, but also the secrecy and competition and recklessness in which the whole operation was carried out. And I found that there was a story here that I had never heard before. They say that every book that you write as a writer is a revenge on your childhood. And I guess that motive carried me so far, but not all the way. Eventually, I began to write in an effort to more fully understand the doublethink of people whose actions so fly in the face of reason. I wanted to figure out how a mythology like Operation Alka can still thrive today and how it fits into our psyche as a society and how it illuminates our attitudes and politics. The characters I wrote about were themselves the subject of intense indoctrination when they were growing up. And there's a sameness to the way they express themselves in their writing. So it was fascinating for me to sink into their personalities and to find really dramatically different experiences and voices. I disagreed with these characters profoundly, and I entered them as intimately as I knew how. The bones of the story were given to me by history, but as I worked, 5 Wives became what it needed to be, a character-driven novel. I entered the point of view of Elizabeth Elliott with great interest. She was a brilliant woman, and she was also unswerving in her ideology. I wanted to know how those 2 qualities can coexist. I wanted to imagine the thoughts and feelings that lie behind explanations like, God told me to do it. I entered Marge Saint, and I have to say I found a lot of joy, actually, in writing Marge Saint. She was the wife of the pilot, Nate Saint. She was a practical, loving young mother with 3 tiny children. She was expected to obey her husband as she would obey God, and I wanted to ask, can she be considered complicit? I entered Rachel Saint, who was the sister of Nate Saint. She was a single woman and a real outlier in this group. She's almost a 19th century figure in how openly she expressed her imperialist ambitions. And her biography, you will cringe to know, is called A Saint Among Savages. She didn't fit the missionaries' narrative, and they virtually effaced her from the record. Yet she was absolutely the linchpin of the events in this story, and I did not write her out. So I'm going to read you two pages tonight from Rachel Saint's point of view. In this passage, Rachel has just run out of the communal dining room. She's been made angry and humiliated because the missionary men made a joke about her singleness. Such is Rachel's pain that she spends the next hour kneeling at the throne of God. She waits with a folded towel under her knees, pressing her face into the pillow. She can hear the others moving quietly below, but no one comes up the stairs to inquire as to her sudden exit. "You gave me victory over this," she says to the Lord, "just the other morning. So what the tarnation is going on?" It takes God a while to answer. "I'm not fond of lies," he finally says. "There's the little matter of you converting Chief Tariri." Chief Tariri of the Shapras, who had so raised her hope 6 months ago when he knelt with her in his hut on the bank of the Maranaran River and prayed in a paroxysm of emotion, clear evidence of guilt and the conviction of sin. And then 2 days later, a terrible massacre took place upriver. When Chief Tariri returned to the settlement, she went straight in and confronted him. "Did you invite Jesus into your heart?" He looked directly at her and said, "Yes, but he didn't come." Anger rises like bilge water in her chest. For God to rebuke her with this, and in any case, what is a lie? Sometimes the moment you imagine and long for, the event that should by rights have transpired, that's where you're going to find the real truth. She sends this up to the Lord, but it's too subtle for him, and a long silence follows. And then she digs in. "Consider my grievance against you," she cries. "Marge, you seem to adore Marge. You've made her plump and happy, given her everything. You want truth? The plain truth is that my sister-in-law has created a full-time job for herself as a broodmare. And now this Mary Lou person, how can they even use the term missionary? So tell me why they are respected when I am not. Is this fair?" "Fair," God says. "It's not a word I recognize." "Well, maybe you should enlighten me," Rachel rages silently, silently, her face pressed into the pillow, "as to why you call single girls out to these stinking jungles only to be sneered at by their own people. The danger and the loneliness, don't you consider that enough? Having nobody to trade glances with at the supper table? Never a loving hand on the nape of your neck? Is the workwoman not worthy of her hire?" Nothing comes back. She waits, but nothing comes back. Her feet have fallen asleep. They're dead from the ankles down. She hauls herself up and undresses and gets into bed. Doors open and close in the hallway. A man's voice next door, and then a woman's. Ed and Mary Lou talking just too low for her to make out the words. She listens in vain for Jim. Her thoughts fall away. She starts to drift. Pictures crowd into her mind and transmogrify the way they will. Dolls in sparkling dresses in the alcoves of the cathedrals, angels or brides or the glory of the Lord. It was a virgin that bore our Lord, wasn't it? She's lying on her side and her shoulder is cramping. She rolls over, washed back up to wakefulness. And there's the answer, as vivid as if it were backlit. The Auca in their green world, faces turned imploringly towards her. A stained glass window with its pure and simple lines. A private shrine to hope. Thank you.
Thank you, Joan. It's so exciting to see the slides that live behind that novel. What an incredible project. Our next writer comes to us from Montreal. Taras Grasco is a writer who's taken on all sorts of fascinating projects in the course of his writing career, and he's coming to us tonight with a new book called Possess the Air, Fascism, Freedom, and the Fate of Mussolini's Rome. Did I get it right?
No.
No. You better come and fix it for me.
Jeez.
Please welcome Taras Grasco.
So I just got this book into my hot little hands a couple of hours ago. I actually rode a bike out to Nally Robinson to get it. It had been shipped here. And the reason there's some confusion about the subtitle is that it changed. No, you didn't mispronounce it or anything. It's now called Possess the Air, Love, Heroism, and the Battle for the Soul of Mussolini's Rome. And in fact, there's a point to that because it is the story of three love affairs and one sort of hate affair that I have with this subject. I'll show you some pictures. I got a little slideshow for you, and then I'll do a short reading from the book. Do we have those images? There we go. So the three love affairs are, first of all, the love affair between this handsome devil, Lauro de Bossis. He was an Italian-American poet. On his mother's side, they're descended from the people who started the first Methodist church in Rome, if you can believe it. And his father was Italy's leading translator of Shelley, an Italian man. And he was a really interesting product of sort of American Puritanism and Italian Romanticism. And a romanticism especially obsessed with the romantics like Shelley and Keats, etc. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who was the most famous monologuist of the 20th century. Can we go to the next one? Her name was... By the way, all of these pictures are taken from archives. I apologize in advance for the poor quality. I actually held up my iPad to the photos to take them in a lot of cases. But I think they're raw and real because of that. This is Ruth Draper. I got this from the New York Historical Society archives. And she was Lauro de Bossis's lover. She was significantly older than him. They met when she was already in her early 40s. He was 17 years younger. But they had a wonderful love affair. The other love affair, if we can go back one slide... Eric, can we go back one slide? Now, these are from the Art Gallery of Ontario archives, and this is Gilbert and Stuart Bagnani in 1929 on their marriage day in Toronto. He's a Canadian, Italian-Canadian archaeologist. She was the product of sort of a family compact, upper-crust Toronto family. And they were also in love with Rome, and they spent a lot of time in Rome. What these two couples have in common is their reaction to the rising tide of violence that was occurring in Mussolini's Rome in the 1920s and 30s. There's another love affair in this book, and that's my own love affair with the city of Rome, which is how this project all started. I've been to Rome many times, and in the depths of a Montreal winter, I was imagining ways to get back to the city that I'd fallen in love with. I managed. I didn't, I've been there half a dozen times, and I spent about 2 or 3 weeks in the Archivio Centrale dello Stato, which is this Mussolini-era building, which was supposed to be the war ministry, that now holds all of the files of the 20 years of fascist rule in Italy. Lauro's story, Lauro is the focus of the book. He's an interesting guy. He was, his Puritan side, which he inherited from his mother, it meant that he was really a man of principle. And he was initially one of the younger generation, he was born in 1901, who were intrigued by Mussolini and the fascists and their energy. And they were seen as replacing the corrupt liberals who were ruling the country at the time. The liberal politicians tended to be a lot older, and they were seen as being very ineffectual. They didn't do much for the country. And they were seen as betraying the country in the First World War. Lauro quickly changed his mind when he saw the way that violence infected everyday life in Mussolini's Italy. He was sort of a golden boy. He was incredibly charming, handsome. He would at parties, he would make little origami birds that he'd make their wings flap. And he was obsessed with Pegasus and flight. And that's the other part of his story. He taught himself to fly. And at a time when no information was coming in from the outside, he bombarded Mussolini's palazzo, the Palazzo Venezia, in a small plane and distributed hundreds of thousands of anti-fascist pamphlets over the city and then flew off into the night. So that is sort of the narrative core of this work of narrative nonfiction. Let's keep on going through the slides. By the way, the Bagnanis were friends with Lauro. They knew each other's families. Here's something I found in the Bagnanis files. This is one of the postcards of Mussolini you could find everywhere in Rome at the time. It was said he was the most photographed man in history. He was photographed in 2,000 different poses, sometimes with his shirt off, scything wheat with the peasants, playing his violin, or with his pet baby lion, a lioness actually, which he'd cruise around Rome with in the back of his Alfa Romeo. Let's go to the next slide, see what we got. This is a small plane that Lauro de Bossis learned to fly and flew from the south of France over Corsica, over the Tyrrhenian Sea, and bombarded Rome with his propaganda pamphlets and books of poetry. It was an interesting gesture and a lot more significant than you might think, because at the time, Mussolini claimed that nobody could penetrate the inviolable sky over Rome or Italy. Lauro de Bossis' gesture in 1931 pricked the fascist bubble in a significant way. It was greeted as a very heroic gesture, and battalions in the Spanish Civil War would be named after him. It was interesting going into the files in the Archivio Centrale dello Stato, because the fascists were obsessed with this guy, and for years afterwards, they were trying to track him down after his heroic flight over Rome. They were reporting sightings of him all over the world. Let's go to the next slide. What do I have? Lauro de Bossis' legacy lingers in Rome today. Part of my story centers on the American Academy in Rome, which is up on the Janiculum Hill, where many of the figures in this story met, people like Thornton Wilder and Sinclair Lewis. You'll notice that Lauro is looking out towards the Tyrrhenian Sea, away from, say, the Pantheon and the Spanish Steps. You'll notice that his neck has a line around it. That's because neo-fascists are constantly beheading the statue, and it has to be repaired constantly. And this is a book, I believe it's a timely book, because we're seeing the rise of authoritarians around the world. Italy has its own problems. It recently got rid of Salvini, which is a good thing. But I said that this was a story of sort of three love affairs, the Bagnanis, the love affair between Lauro and Ruth Draper, my own love affair with Rome. It's also a question of hatred and how people bore witness to the rise of hatred and violence and how they reacted to it and how people of conscience, like Lauro de Bossis, found a way to speak out against it. And that's why it's a book I really wanted to write. There aren't many heroes left in the world. And Lauro de Bossis was a genuine hero. He's a hero who was known in his time but has been forgotten. And his gesture his quixotic gesture at a time when no other information was coming into Italy. He organized a series, before his gesture, he organized a series of chain letters that went out by the tens of thousands to the leading figures, the leading intellectuals in Italy, imploring them to fight against the regime and telling them ways to do it. Mussolini had the press sewn up. He controlled all the information that came out of newsreels. He personally oversaw the layout of many of the leading daily newspapers. So we live in a very different time now. There is an abundance of information. There's too much information, and there's a lot of disinformation. I wanted to explain why this gesture was important at the time. And we'll just continue. Thanks, Eric. So after I visited Lauro de Bossi's statue, I walked a little farther to the Piazza Lauro de Bossi, which is in a beautiful bend on the Tiber River. I don't know if you can read this, but this is a 30-meter-tall obelisk based on the Egyptian obelisks that the Romans plundered from North Africa. It says Mussolini Dux, which is the D-U-X, which is the old Latin term for Il Duce. It still stands, ironically, in the Piazza Lauro de Bossi. Italy never erased the legacy of fascism. You can see it all over the country. It's an unfortunate thing because when you fail to cope with evils of the past, they have a tendency to recur. And this book, though I hope it reads like a novel, is also a bit of a warning. I'll read from the prologue. A lucky walker in Rome, wearying of dodging gelato eaters and rushing motorini, may be lured out of the teeming streets of Trastevere by the prospect of the upward sloping paving stones of the sycamore-shaded Via Garibaldi. To the right, a side street dead-ends in flights of well-worn stone steps, bordered on one side by fortifications built by a third-century emperor to repel barbarous Germanic tribes. The staircase ascends alongside crumbling bricks overgrown with wildflowers and canary grass to a piazza dominated by a striking monument in luminous travertine limestone. The Fontana dell'Acqua Paola is a confection of the High Baroque, built around five niches, divided by columns of red granite and topped by high-perched griffins, lines of stone-cut Latin, and a gossamer iron cross, out of which water gushes into a cerulean basin, as shallow as it is enticing. The pet project of a 17th-century pope is fed by the same ancient aqueduct that once filled Trastevere's Naumachia, the artificial lake where the Emperor Trajan staged mock naval battles using galleys rowed by real slaves. Taxi drivers know it simply as the Fontanone, the big fountain. The Fontana dell'Acqua Paola, however, is merely the backdrop to a far more impressive spectacle. Crossing the paving stones of the semicircular piazza, the fortunate stroller approaches a curved stone balustrade, which projects like a proscenium over the most sumptuous of playhouses. Just beyond the high canopies of thin-trunked umbrella pines, the first metropolis of the world unscrolls to the limits of peripheral vision. Ecco, Roma. In the foreground, quadrilaterals of weathered stucco in hues of ochre and pink form a cubist jumble, jostling around the bend in the Tiber that snags Trastevere, the most ancient and authentic of Rome's rioni, or central neighborhoods, like a bishop's crozier. Across the river, the hemispheric roof of the two-millennia-old Pantheon, the largest dome in the world until well into the 20th century, protrudes from rococo cupolas, a concrete barnacle cemented fast to the medieval and Renaissance city. And, white as sun-bleached Belline, the Brescian marble of the Vittoriano, that pretentious monument to the earthiest of Italy's kings, rises against the impressionist smear of blue on the eastern horizon, the foreboding Sabine and Alban Hills. The Latin satirist Martial, who owned a villa near the crest of this hill, the Janiculum, wrote of the vista, "From here you can see the seven lordly hills and measure the whole of Rome." The only reminders that this is the second decade of the 21st century are the cell phone masts that bristle from certain strategic eminences and the occasional contrail of an airplane that scumbles the sky, notably unscraped by towers of glass and steel. It is a view that has consoled generations of visitors, suggesting that humans and their problems come and go, but Roma, the urbs aeterna, the caput mundi, the città aeterna, will always abide. The city's persistence across the centuries seems to offer a salutary rebuke to an unhealthy obsession with the present. But Rome has never been exempt from history. From the balcony of the Janiculum, observers have watched the flames that leapt up from the Temple of Jupiter as Sulla sacked the Forum, the cannonballs that burst in the Piazza Barberini after French gunners dislodged General Garibaldi from the Villa Aurelia, and the columns of smoke that rose from the rubble of the San Lorenzo district after it had been carpet-bombed by flying fortresses in the darkest days of the Second World War. On a warm autumn evening in the ninth year of the fascist era, families that had wandered up to the Janiculum were witness to another dramatic episode in the city's history. As the sun set on October 3, 1931, a dot appeared in the western sky. In the gathering twilight, it quickly resolved itself into a fuselage that sprouted crimson-tipped wings. People stopped to watch its progress, for aircraft were no longer a common sight in Rome. The fascists liked to boast that not even a swallow dared to penetrate the sky over the capital without their permission. Whoever the pilot was, he was flying silently in a controlled downwards glide. Heads swiveled as the plane passed above the treetops and crossed the Tiber on what seemed like a certain collision course with the Palazzo where, as the day's newspapers had announced, Il Duce and the leading members of the fascist Grand Council had gathered to work late into the night. In the cockpit, a young man looked out over the rooftops of his hometown and wagged the wings of his little plane in triumph. Through a daring act of bravado, he was about to reveal what, for almost a decade, the dictatorship had been striving to conceal from the world. Mussolini didn't know what was about to hit him.
Good point. Take note. Important to know history so that we know where we're going to. Thank you, Tara Skresko. Our third reader this evening is Candace Savage, who is coming to us from Saskatoon. And she's a really splendid book about exploring an old house that is hers called Strangers in the House. Will you please welcome Candace Savage?
Thank you very much, Charlene. It's an honor and a really great pleasure to be in your company tonight. I can't see you, but I know you're there. It's such a pleasure to be able to tell you a bit. Hi, there you are. Hooray. It's such a great pleasure to be able to tell you about this book, Strangers in the House. It too has a subtitle. It's called A Prairie Story of Bigotry and Belonging. The house, as Charlene has already suggested, the house in the title is my house in Saskatoon, a house built in 1928 that has been home to me and my family for the last 30 years. And the strangers have a shifting and deepening meaning. They've taken on, that word has taken on new meanings as my research has progressed. But in the first instant, the strangers were the first family to live in that house. And I first met their name, a long time ago, when my daughter, who is now 40, was 11. And one day she came home from school with this little piece of paper on which she'd been to the local history room at the library, and she came home with a list of all the heads of household to have lived in our house. There I was at the top of the list just by showing up. I'd gone down in the history books.
And then there were seven or eight other names, all quite, you know, ordinary, inscrutable names. And the first one was Blondin Napoleon S. And we were immediately struck that this was a very French name. If you know anything about the history of Saskatoon, you'll know it was founded by Methodists from Toronto as a temperance colony. And it was supposed to be a wasp nest. This was supposed to be a very Anglo kind of community. So what were these people, you know, and if there were to be people who were marked as ethnics, they were supposed to be on the other side of the river from where we were, not in this, the sacred ground that had been laid out by the temperance colony. So we were immediately curious. But the years passed, and eventually we did some renovations in our kitchen, and this great blizzard of shavings that had, you know, been put in as a sad excuse for insulation came tumbling out of the walls, and in amongst them was the frayed collar from a man's shirt, some children's arithmetic assignments, recipes, some photographic negatives. And though it took me many, many years to realize this, the lid of a toy box, and on it it said, Ralph Blondin. So inside the very walls of this house were memories of this family, the family of Napoleon S. Blondin. Some other things happened, but eventually I started doing some digging. Doing that, you know, I fell down the rabbit hole called ancestry.ca and started to trace back the history of this family, which quite quickly was traceable back to France, to New France, across the country, and eventually to Saskatchewan. But while I was doing that research, I left behind some digital footprints. I asked questions, and, you know, my curiosity was recorded in this public record. And so one day, to my enormous surprise, I got a message that said, Howdy, you seem to have been researching my wife's grandfather. So it is true, I'd been, you know, sneaking around investigating someone else's family history. So I said, well, yeah, that was me. And the next thing I knew, I was introduced to two of the granddaughters from this family. And it turned out that not only were they also curious about their family history, because partly I think because it had been a very difficult family to grow up in and be part of, but also, well, because of that, a lot had been forgotten. And it turned out that they had a memory that their grandfather had built a house in Saskatoon, and that we were able very quickly to figure out through contacting one of the sons, who as a very young person had lived in that house, that my house was actually the house. They hadn't just lived there, they had built that house. So this was a house that the family had always remembered, but they'd lost track of. They didn't know where it was anymore. So the next thing I knew, here come Lorena and her sister Fran. They're on the front step, and they've come to see the house that their grandfather built, a house that their own father had told them about. And with them, they've brought a photo album. There's a picture of my house when it was being built. And there's another one of the three little kids in this family. They're standing on the boulevard beside the house. You can see the other houses in the background. And at first I think they're in peonies. But, you know, it took me a long time. I'm sometimes a little slow about these things. But I eventually realized it was potatoes that the mom, Clarissa Marie Perron, but always they told me she was called Clara. Clara had planted potatoes, and here are her three oldest children standing in this potato patch outside my house. So They tell me family stories. They tell me how their dad had always said that there was a lot of shouting in this household, and that he would sit on the stairs up to the upstairs and he would listen to the adults shouting down below in the rest of the house. So suddenly, this place that had been full of stick figures was starting to become inhabited by real memory. So I'm going to read you just two short passages from this book. The first one is about that first visit with Fran and her sister. And it represents the kind of intimacy that this story sometimes is able to hold. It comes from a chapter called Making Connections, which has an epigraph from a poem written by someone named Sully Prudhomme in 1869, and it goes like this. Je n'aime pas les maisons neuves, leur visage est indifférent. Les anciennes ont l'air des veuves qui se souviennent en pleurant. I don't like new houses. Their face is uncaring. Old ones have the air of widows who remember through tears. As much as I'd enjoyed meeting the Blondin sisters, I have to admit that their visit had left me a little bruised. Before they arrived, I'd felt quite smug about how much I knew, all the precious scraps of information that I'd pulled out of the woodwork, both figurative and literal. But Lorena, in particular, had made me see how much I still had to learn. The characters I'd been pursuing through my research were as two-dimensional as stick men, mere names and dates on the page. And even at that beginner's level of understanding, I hadn't always succeeded in getting things straight. Unless I wanted to embarrass myself in front of their uncle, Uncle Chick, I was going to have to do a lot more homework. For instance, one of the pictures in Lorena's album was an almost unreadable portrait of a bearded man with a beekeeper's veil drawn over his head, manhandling a large wooden hive. Cleophas, she said, he was NS's, Napoleon's father. You know that, right? Yes. This is the only photo we have of him, but I think he must have been quite a character. You saw where he'd listed himself on the census as a free thinker? No, I'd missed that. Just as I'd missed any and all mention of his third wife, Philomène, who died after the family came west and was buried in the cemetery at the small town of Harris, Saskatchewan. And while I knew that the Blondins had homesteaded in that district and that Napoleon had run a store in town, I didn't know about the time his business had burned down. No, I hadn't observed the shocking admission on his marriage certificate, the gaping blank where his mother's name should have appeared. No, I hadn't noticed the 20-year difference in ages that separated him from his wife, Clara. The lesson was painfully clear. If I hoped to come close to understanding what had befallen this deeply rooted French-Canadian family when it was transplanted to the West, I was going to have to dial up my attention to detail. And even then, even on full alert, I could easily misread the clues. I'd always assumed, for example, that people like the Blondins, who have a coherent ethnic identity, would be proud of who they were. This is partly because my own mixed European background makes me something of a mutt. As a child, when I'd ask my mom about our ethnicity, she'd reply casually, "You're a little bit of this and that, dear. Heinz 57, really." So it seemed to me that the Blondins, who had spoken and sung and, yes, shouted at each other in French since the beginning of time, would be proud of their heritage and on guard to defend it. Whether they spoke Quebec French or Métis French, they would have loved their language. But no, this had not been the case, not for Clara. That's what my dad said, Lorena had told me. If my grandfather spoke to her in French, she refused to answer him, even at home. No French, only English. I was stunned by this revelation. Why would anyone ever think of imposing such a grotesque rule? No French, not even in the privacy of your own four walls. This is not what I had expected of this much-loved grandmother. Yet, come to think of it, there was not a single word of French on the pages that had tumbled out of the walls. Pas de recette de glaçage, just recipes for frosting from the Boston Cooking School. Desensitized by the normalcy of an English-only world, I hadn't even noticed that the Blondins had parted company with their ancestors. I think my grandmother was lonely, Lorena said, when she saw how shocked I was. She just wanted to make friends. The other women, I don't think they ever let her in. Twists my heart to think of it. How lonely would you have to be to give up your mother tongue? So if the first question that I was investigating was just who were these people, soon that was what I needed to understand. What would have motivated Clara Blondin to make that dramatic decision? And what I quickly discovered was that even though I've lived in Western Canada my whole life and have always been fascinated by our history, I really didn't know very much about it. I had no idea what an influence the Orange Order, for example, which we associate with the sectarian violence in Ireland, I had no idea how powerful and pervasive an influence that had been for a very long time in English Canada. And then things got worse. So this is from I've jumped ahead about, 150 pages or something. The Invisible Empire, Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Canada, can you hear the K's? Arrived in the province of Saskatchewan in the closing week of 1926 at the behest of the organization's national headquarters in Toronto. Things had gotten a bit sticky for the movement in Ontario that autumn when two of its members were found guilty of setting dynamite in St. Mary's Roman Catholic Church in Barrie. An ideal moment, the leadership thought, for a change of venue. Accordingly, a team of experienced operatives was dispatched to Saskatchewan. A King Klegal, or chief organizer, named Lewis A. Scott, assisted by his son Hugh, as Clockard, or clan lecturer, and a Clockard named Pat Emmons. All three were American citizens who had previously risen to prominence as leaders of the Indiana Klan, where they had peddled an intoxicating mixture of white supremacy, xenophobia, anti-Catholic bigotry, old-time religion, and pure Americanism. So potent was their appeal that by the mid-1920s, Klan-sponsored candidates had taken control of both the state assembly and the governor's office. In 1925, however, their reign came to an abrupt end when the state's leading Klansman, Grand Dragon D.C. Stevenson, was convicted in the abduction, rape, and murder of a female civil servant. It's possible, I suppose, that word of these atrocities had not found its way to the scattered towns and cities of the Saskatchewan Plains. But even if people were in the dark about the Klan's recent misdeeds, everybody knew, or should have known, about its historical infamy. The first full-length American movie shown in Saskatoon had been D.W. Griffith's epic blockbuster, The Birth of a Nation, which was screened at the Empire Theater on 20th Street in the spring of 1916 to the accompaniment of a 20-piece orchestra. Admission was a hefty $1.50, up from the usual 25 cents. But that didn't keep the show from playing to enthusiastic audiences. As the music swelled to its martial climax, Legions of robed and hooded horsemen thundered across the screen, first defeating a mob of African-American insurgents and then rescuing a white maiden from the clutches of a mixed-race man. In case anyone missed the significance of these developments, an intertitle flashed up to provide an explanation. The white race had come together in common defense of their Aryan birthright. Although the revitalized Second Clan, the movement that rode into Saskatchewan in the 1920s, had officially forsworn violence, it remained unapologetically committed to white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant domination. The Klan was a religious movement, its promoters cried, motivated solely by a desire to rid society of sin. Attributes that made it, in Clockhart Emmons' words, the greatest Christian benevolent fraternal organization in the world today. But benevolent did not mean spineless. The Klan was tough on non-preferred immigration, tough on papist interference, tough on sectarian schools. We fed people antis, Emmons would later confess. Whatever we found that they could be taught to hate and fear, we fed them. We were out to get the dollars, and we got them. Across the province, voices were raised against the Klan, from the pulpit, in the legislature, and in the press. But it was difficult ground to hold. Even the Klan's most ardent opponents were pro-British and pro-status quo. The standard-bearer for the anti-Klan forces, the Liberal Premier, James G. Jimmy Gardner, claimed that the Klan's greatest evil was getting people riled up about a problem that didn't exist. "Let's just calm down," he counseled, "and look at the statistics. Roman Catholics made up 20% of the population, but only 12% of the employees in the Department of Education. They were underrepresented in cabinet and across the civil service as a whole. Obviously, there was no papist threat." But the discrimination the premier had exposed passed without comment. Back in the Blondin's pretty little house on a gracious street in Saskatoon, a child is huddled on the staircase, listening to his parents shout, "No French," he hears his mother say. "Don't you dare speak French in this house." Thank you very much.
That's Candace Savage. Thank you, Candace. It's a really fascinating story, and again, the kind of resonance of times past and times present, really important. I just mentioned quickly that Candace is going to be reading again from Strangers in the House tomorrow at Maison Gabrielois in our own St. Boniface, French region, along with Ariel Gordon, because Candace is also a naturalist, and then there's going to be a lovely walkabout on the Gabrielois Trail, so that's just a little aside. And so we're going to be able to hear this really fascinating story placed inside of a French home, which I think is also going to have a lovely resonance. So will you join me in thanking our first three writers? And now we'll have a little break. You're welcome to come forward, have a drink, buy a book, get some books signed, have a chat. If you haven't had a chance yet to put your ballot into the draw box, you don't have a pen? There's a draw box over here. Please enter to win the books. But come on forward now. Thank you. It's a rowdy crowd tonight. So do you want to know who won the draw? Georgina. Georgina Rome. Where are you, Georgina? You won! You can wait till after the show to start reading, though, Gina, okay? So such an interesting evening, and we have another half equally interesting, slightly different angles. Both of the stories coming up have a much more personal dimension, and they are also about real life lived up close and with great texture. Our first writer is Jenny Hydren-Wills, who lives here in Winnipeg. She teaches at the University of Winnipeg, and her new, wonderful new book is called Older Sister, Not Necessarily Related, and you may or may not know, but it has hit the Giller list, so please welcome Jenny Wills. I lied. It hit the Hillary Weston. There it is. That's the prize list. Try it again.
Thank you. That was some surprise news for me. As a nonfiction writer, especially. Thank you so much to Thin Air, to everyone for joining us all tonight. This is a memoir about Korean adoption, and I wanted to write one that was a little bit different from those that I had seen. And so it takes as its starting off point reunion, actually. So it's not the typical story that starts in youth and then finds its way to a return to country of origin, to culture of origin. It's one that starts off with the reunion with the birth family. And I was really intrigued being invited to speak on this panel about real life because for Korean adoptees and a lot of adopted people from various countries, cultures, and experiences, the idea of realness is quite perplexing. Even being someone who wrote a memoir is a bit of a task because it dawned on me at some point that people expect memoirists to tell the truth, at least somewhat. But truth is always something that's fleeting for adoptees. Whether you can access any semblance of truth in the first place, it feels so abstract. But then truth also sometimes changes as you age and you uncover different stories that themselves maybe are unbelievable and in fact shouldn't be believed. So if you will indulge me, I've chosen four brief passages that I think speak to the ways I'm thinking about real life and truth in life writing. The first is from the preface, and I wanted to include this sort of statement as a preface because for me, I don't feel that there is a way to fully tell the truth in this memoir. And so it's a little bit of a disclaimer that way. The second passage is one that gestures to the ways that other people think about adopted people and specifically Korean adoptees. The third passage that I chose is a little bit different, and it comes in the form of a direct address. So throughout this memoir, I speak to my older sister, amongst other people, to say some things that are maybe too difficult to say to an unspecific audience. So that particular passage I chose for tonight because it deals with a very sort of current event issue, and that is the deportation of transnationally adopted people. And then the last section is a little bit longer, and it is one in which my Korean mother, through a translator, confesses to me the story of my birth. Okay, so they're all short, I swear to you. So the preface. Sure. The preface. This story, these stories are not all mine. Some of them, in fact, belong to no one at all, but are the fantasies that seem to flower so naturally from the mouths of those of us who've grown lives out of half facts, wishful thinking, and outright lies, who piece themselves together from the residue of lost records, from withheld and secreted records, whose orphanages and agencies have been evasively destroyed by fire and flood or by shame. We're told there's nothing left of the people or places we might have had. We're told they, and our knowledge of them, do not belong to us. They never did. And so, these stories are nothing special, only echoes of memories and alibis, but they're all I have. For this second section, I should mention there's a little bit of a curse word in here, so if you're sensitive to those things, it's a little bit rated R. Okay. They call people like me, people like us, damaged. You're broken, they say, and they shake their heads sadly, watching us waste our lives trying to find our Korean parents, brothers, sisters, anyone. They witness us handing over our DNA to private companies that boast vast databases and so offer a slim possibility of making connections between biological kin. They see us become wanderers in our birth country, sailing from guest house to guest house, bleeding a trail of money and self-esteem from one corner of the country to another. They write books about how we storm adoption agencies and grab at files that are neither our own nor in a language we can read. They laugh at how we fall down drunk and convince ourselves that sleeping with others who are there for the same reasons is part of the therapy. They purse their lips and roll their eyes when we let Korean men fuck us even though we can't pronounce their names and know we'll never see them again. Daddy issues, they smirk. Need that receipt for later. On me, which means older sister, not necessarily related. On me, I need to talk to you about a man whom I think about every day, a beautiful man who flew into the night when at last he said, enough. Because under the care of a leader who promised change, who promised hope, spray-painted red and white and black and blue, he was ripped from the only country he knew and returned. A factory defect from the assembly line that promises butterfly kisses and violin prodigies. Undocumented, inconvenient, he was no longer the gyupta ticket to Protestant heaven. He was no longer baby lift, baby gift that keeps on giving. He grew into a man. A beautiful Korean man, a beautiful interrupted Korean man who came to the United States as an 8-year-old boy whose white parents branded him with their name and thought that was all there was to it. Deported, unregistered, stateless, homeless, wordless, on me. Were you working your shift at Incheon International the day this beautiful interrupted Korean man landed in a country that had not only forgotten him, but had sold him 30 years earlier? There are many people like him in Seoul, in Busan, in Daegu, all over. They're washing your dishes and cleaning your homes and doing any other job where they don't have to speak. They don't have to interact with the people who'd rather forget that 75 years after the fighting has stopped, Korea still exports children at thousands of dollars a pop. Did you hear about this beautiful interrupted Korean man on me when in the news when his ashes arrived back in Pennsylvania and they announced that in death he finally came to the U.S. legally? You know they send us over. They send us around the world. Infants alone on airplanes, ashes labeled cargo, mail order our entire lives. Did you think of me, made of papers forged to close a sale, without family registry, without birth certificate or accurate passport? Did you know on me? The window of the 5th-floor hotel room we'd rented for the weekend bowed towards the ocean overlooking Hyundae Beach. It was mid-October, and there were four of us. The Korean professor, who was my connection at the college, one of her students, Omma, which means mother in Korean, and me. We're in Busan for the annual International Film Festival. Mats of different colors were folded and piled to one side. Later that night, they'd be our beds. The wood floor was already starting to warm, and the sea was angry, lunging against and over the straight barriers, surprising drivers as they tried to parallel park. It was 2 months into my time in Korea and dusk, so the ashes of 100 fireplaces swarmed the air and stuck to people's hair like flakes of dead skin. Without daylight savings, autumn in Korea meant extraordinary darkness. At the time, I didn't really consider the risk my mother took in coming on that weekend trip, but it must have been high. It was the second occasion we would sleep together the way mothers and daughters in Korea do. It had seemed like a good idea when, back in Seoul a few weeks earlier, the professor proposed the small vacation. When it was happening, though, I was bored by Korean conversation that kept me apart from the rest of the group. There was a bag of grapes, some cherry tomatoes, a cake, but I stayed to the side of the open room holding a dictionary to my chest and looking out the window. But then, unprompted, Oma told the story of my birth. When she started, it was to no one but the unfurnished room. Maybe she was overcome by the need to tell, knowing the professor could hear her, that the student could hear her, and together they could translate her words to me. Maybe it would be her only chance, our only chance. This is how our kinship has always needed to exist, through third parties. My mother told me about the day I was born, but we needed strangers to bear witness. "I threw away your clothes," she said before anyone was paying much attention. "The clothes I bought before you were born." Oma promised she'd not been ashamed when I was growing inside her, even though my father was married, even though he had already one child, a son, still a baby. He'd promised we'd be a family instead, him, Oma, me. They rented an apartment. I wondered who signed the lease, but I was afraid to interrupt. Now I wish I had. It makes a difference who signed it. She was in Seoul to work. She was sewing in a factory, as she'd continued to do for decades, as she was doing still when we met earlier that year. Her family was in Gimcheon, hours away, worlds away. She was young. She loved him. He sang to her. His hair was thick with curls. His skin, like hers, was dark and rich. He was taller than most Korean men. He had freckles. He was from the city, and she couldn't believe he wanted to love her. And then she didn't believe he ever actually did. I was afraid to move. I was afraid she'd stop talking. At times, I looked out the window, but it was pitch black, and I saw only our reflections mirrored back. I was holding my breath. She was holding my hand. Another baby came, my sister, on me, also with his wife. She must look like her mother because she doesn't look like her father and she doesn't look like me. He lived between homes, sometimes with his already born children, sometimes with my mother. And then, only a few months later, I arrived. It was early morning. She remembered that. Her parents were there. I was quiet. She had been dreaming of persimmon and rock fruit during her pregnancy, so she knew I'd be a girl. She swore the room filled with the smell of iron and cinnamon when I emerged. My father was there. His parents were there. None of them looked at her. None of them looked at me. Panicked because she remembered the stress of her pregnancy, my mother scanned me, counting every finger, every toe, rolling each one between her index finger and thumb. Then, in the hallway, my grandfather was talking to someone Oma didn't know. Then he was talking to his son, my father. Then he slapped his son, my father, across the face and walked away. Then my father walked away too. I couldn't breathe. The professor was crying as she translated Oma's words. The student was also crying. The stranger came into the birthing room. She had papers in her hand. Someone lifted me from Oma's arms. The stranger said something about a god Oma wouldn't know until decades later. Something about doing the right thing. Something about the future. The story slowed to a stop around there. The waves of tension and pain broke. There was nothing else to say. Exhaustion rushed in. But when it was done, Oma held on to me, awkward because we were two grown women seated on the floor, so our legs got in the way. She held my hand still. She offered me her breast, something she'd not thought of or hadn't the time for when first she bore me into the world. I declined, saddened. Most of what had been told didn't register in the moment. It would come back to me in memory later. Because early on, something my mother said triggered three words that repeated blood pulse and thunder in my head. Louder than my history and my mother's life secrets unfurling, spread out immodestly in front of strangers. Louder than the still raging ocean, water breaking heart, then pressure, then pain that could split a woman in two. Then quiet awe at what had just happened. That night I cried in front of my mother at last. When she stopped speaking and the room vibrated, those three words fell from my mouth over and over. The only thing I'd say in response to her telling, you wanted me. Thank you.
Jenny Wills, thank you so much. That was a really, really extraordinary experience to share a brand new book. You're launching next week at McNally's? 2 weeks? 2 weeks. A rule follower. I think there will be many people there also who are really aching to get into that story. Thank you so much. And our final reader this evening is Martha Bailey, who is a novelist who has been here before and is here this time with a memoir that she co-wrote with her sister, Christina. It's called Sister Language. Please welcome Christina Martha Bailey.
Extraordinary readings there have been tonight. Thank you. You have an amazing talent for bringing people together. It's an honor to be here. The book I'm going to read from tonight is a collaborative work. It's the first time I've written with someone else. This is a novel of, well, it's not a novel, it's a book of call and response. And my sister suffered from severe schizophrenia for many decades. She also had a condition called formal thought disorder, which means that language continuously broke apart for her. So if you were to say the word appear, that would almost immediately become app and ear or app and pair. And because of this, she was extremely happy in the land of James Joyce. She loved his texts and read them over and over. She loved Stein and Beckett, and language was a place of both play and survival. And she had very ambiguous feelings about putting her work out into the world. In fact, someone found recently, went back through their emails and found an email she'd sent in 2005 considering trying to get something published, and then within a week had said, no, there's too much of a storm inside my head. And besides, I hate what happens to art when it goes out into the world. And I hate the way the world treats artists. And I hate the complicity of artists in that relationship. I could write a diatribe about this, but my inner pacifist would kill my inner anarchist. Quote, unquote. I had made various forays in the past, but in 2017 I approached her again and asked what would be necessary to bring your work out in the world. And she said, well, if you could produce a sort of prose framework to contextualize my work that we might arrive at something. So we started discussing that, and then she almost immediately said, so my writing will be on one page and yours will be on the other, and that way there will be no contamination. And we agreed to that. And all of her texts were typewritten on a typewriter, so we dug up an old red school binder, and my texts were to be responses to hers. And then we started passing this binder back and forth, and pretty soon the binder would come back and there would be a footnote typed on my page or an answer taped on my page. So I thought, okay, this is interesting. There's some transgression happening. And then she began to type long, dense letters to me and said that she was able to produce this coherent prose because of the context of this particular exchange. And I think she had a very coherent prose to her felt like a sort of betrayal, because she regarded herself as an agglomerate or an aggregate of selves, and this coherence was almost a betrayal. And out of this grew a book that is a mixture of letters and texts written by her and texts written by me and visual elements. And for me, it was kind of terrifying because her language, as you will see when I read a section called Reds, is sort of like a nuclear fission. And mine is very timid next to it. So I'm going to read you a few passages from the very beginning, and then a bit of one of her projects, which was called Reds. I want to write about how schizophrenic cognitive disorganization and formal thought disorder are a piranha that turns the schizophrenic into a pariah. But isn't the subject too overwhelming, too great in its scope? And to be writing from inside the problem as the problem? I turn the key and push. The door begins to swing but bangs against its chain. A barrier she's fashioned from a leash. This means she's home. Mouth to slit. Sister, hello, sister. From some room she comes, the chain unfastened. I step inside, admitted. Begin by admitting. A good beginning, but how much either party will admit or admit to is never a known factor. I've brought a desire. We begin. We've begun before and often. It so happens this day our desires agree to discuss language, the many ways it rescues and fails her. We are readers. She became a reader earlier and more avidly than I. Much lends itself to reading. Here's my reading of her hallway and the two rooms opening off it. Few sources of physical comfort. Evidence of other forms of succor. Objects stacked and ordered, things grouped in evolving compositions, small and large material repetitions, an arid calm, yarn and wire, smell of enclosure, paper, paper, ink, anxiety, leaking and drafting, paint, scissors, typewriter, open box of typewriter ribbons, glue, dust, more paper, language everywhere. Randomness pulls and something pulls back. I am the something, but I'm also its attraction to randomness, or how the random is drawn ineluctably to it, how the random always finds it, me, out. I ask her to comment on the idea of self as resistance. She has taped her answer to the opposite page. The proof that I exist is in transitions from utterly random, in the sense that it is always roiling round language potential, into whatever utterances I am making these ams. I am what makes these transits. I am language potential, unmanifest, infinite, its potentates, taters, eight potent, the lingua fagus am. I think that only language gets my existence. Naturally, since I'm made up of and maddened up by language, it speaks through me, spiels me out, spackles me widely, wildly, it tackles and slicks, sleeks me. I am its stippling, its spittle and slip-ups, and on, so on. Sleep, just out of it, out of it. Might, if could I, out of sleepy ams, their jottings, make something readable? I'm thinking of Renee Gladman's Calamities, Alexis Pauline Gum's Spill. Do wish it that I could, but do it? I can't, not a chance. I don't have that ability, and am too far from life, if life be social, human. When I get out of bed, undoable, unmakeable, unfeasible, emphysema sabotaged, paragraphs are my plan. I hunger for her seeming freedom. Oh, to be spieled out, spackled widely, wildly, tackled and slicked and sleeked by language. Her freedom? Language is the whale that, swallowed, she inhabits. Sounds echo in the live-ribbed vault. I read her, then stare at my timidity, my law-abiding linguistic prudery. For me, the written word is steeped in punishment and humiliation. Memories of school, of failure at spelling, of slowness at reading, haunt the written, making it an ever-present classroom. In its defined, exacting space, I attempt to prove myself, take covert delight, slyly twisting at every opportunity. The sentence, a most private pleasure. Beautiful alignments got me. And then I'm going to read to you very briefly from this project of Christina's called Reds and her tiny introduction to it. Today is the next day. It's around 8 a.m. and I'm as ready, unready, for the roofers as I'll ever be. The extra meds are helping, plus waking surrounded by my Reds. Nothing like being one of an agglomeration of selves, another of whom makes what is necessary for the rest of us to keep us going. The projects are mine, in the sense that they're a few of the projects of an aggregate of selves to which I belong. Agglomeration, aggregate, probably not the right words. Take it from one who knows. Reds lie abed. They are beds of roses unarisen. Reds are rising or about to be. About to be she. Reds set out to be where she. Where will she turn up? Always where the reds are. She, shall. Reds minister to her. What are reds administering at the moment? Reds sap nothing. Reds are pure energy plus the crumbling that is physicality. Reds are shoveling their ahistoricity into a heap, then jumping on it like little demons, purebred red, slamming their bodies into an anthill thrill. Reds pause. Reds bring themselves about as clauses. Reds are sentient sentences. Reds are the grammar that she is at the moment. The moment has tusks. She has red tasks. One task is to redden anything. Through reds, she nears redemption. Clear a space for it. In reds, there are no jurisdictions. There is no jurisprudence. Reds are largely impudent. And she is their impudence. Reds are on the blink. Well, not blanketing. Reds blank out when. So my sister, she saw the galleys of this book and chose the color for the cover, but did not last to see the book. So we have her words.
That's Martha Bailey, Sister Language.
Amazing evening of sharing tonight. Thank you both, and thank you to the three writers from before the break. Will you put your hands together for all five?
Real life takes many forms. I'm so glad you were part of the evening. It's been some moments that are just transformative and transporting. We have just now finished Wednesday, I guess, so we have several days still ahead of us. We are having a great time. I hope that you are as well. Please join us in as many more of the events of Thin Air as you can. But in the moment, you may come forward, have a visit with these two writers or the writers from the first half. There's still time to buy books. You could buy one of those rare, very gorgeous book bags back there, which have the writers' names on it for this year. We're pretty proud of those. What else? Oh, I know. I need to tell you that we do have surveys floating around, because I always forget this and I get, you know, have the sort of self-scolding voice that says, oh, the stuff you forgot. There is an online option. You can go to our website, which is Thin Air Winnipeg, and click on the survey button, or you can fill out the little papers that are floating around. It's really helpful for us to have some feedback from people who are in house for an event like this so that we have an idea how to shape our programming as we move forward. And we also have a 50-50 raffle going on, so if you really want to win some money, you can buy some tickets. This is kind of how that works. So thank you so much for coming out tonight. Please come forward and have a chat. To you.